Today is Thursday, April 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, French President Emmanuel Macron made his case for the United States to stay in the 2015 Iran nuclear deal on Wednesday.
It is true to say that this agreement may not address all concerns, and very important concerns.
But what will President Trump decide? Also, a look ahead as South Korea prepares for the first inter-Korean summit in more than a decade. Plus, a recap on the oral arguments heard at the U.S. Supreme Court on President Trump's travel restrictions. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis told a congressional panel Thursday there has been no decision made on any U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement, but he said Washington is working with its European allies to see if there are ways to improve the pact. German Chancellor Angela Merkel meets with President Donald Trump on Friday. She's expected to press the U.S. to stay within the framework of the Iran nuclear deal. Mr. Trump is expected to decide by May 12th whether to reimpose sanctions against Iran after calling the agreement deeply flawed. The issue dominated talks between Mr. Trump and visiting French President Emmanuel Macron, who told journalists late Wednesday he would not be surprised if Mr. Trump pulled out of the accord. The French leader told a joint meeting of Congress, while imperfect, the U.S. should abide by the agreement's terms until a new, stronger, more expansive deal can be forged.
It is true to say that this agreement may not address all concerns, and very important concerns. But we should not abandon it without having something substantial and more substantial instead. Your president and your country will have to take in the current days and weeks its own responsibilities regarding this issue. But what I want to do, and what we decided together with your president, is that we can work on a more comprehensive deal addressing all these concerns. That is why we have to work on this more comprehensive deal based, as discussed with President Trump yesterday, on four pillars. The substance of the existing agreement, the post-2025 period, in order to be sure that we will never have any nuclear activity for Iran. The containment of the military influence of the Iranian regime in the region, and the monitoring of ballistic activity. I think these four pillars are the one which cover the legitimate fears of the United States and our allies in the region.
University of Denver International Affairs Professor Jonathan Adelman tells VOA's International Edition Victor Beatty the French leader offered the U.S. leader a way out of his disagreement with other co-signatories to the Iran deal.
To say, look, we've got the six nations to sign this agreement, the other five don't want to change it, but we'll address your concerns about ballistic missiles, your concerns about nuclear weapons, your concerns about, you know, terrorism and chemical warfare and so forth. And so I thought that was really something. And you saw Democrats and Republicans getting up on their feet 20, 30 times and cheering him because they saw there was a way out. And the Iranians will not be happy with it. The question will be whether they'd accept it or not. But and the other possibility is some of the other countries, especially perhaps the British, to less likely the Germans, might also be willing to come along. So I thought that was a really good first try by the French politician who'd never done anything political in his life.
The U.S. Non-Proliferation Envoy in Geneva, Christopher Ford, said the U.S. is not seeking to reopen or renegotiate the Iran nuclear deal, but hopes to stay in it to fix its flaws with a supplementary agreement.
I think that's close to what the French president, Macron, wanted to get. I think that is the most likely way that things are going to move here. And the other thing that we want that is very important is not only to know about their ballistic missile program and to stop it, but to be able to inspect it. We don't have the right to inspect it on a regular basis.
Sir, isn't this all theoretical if Iran rejects any additions or changes to the original deal?
It is, but we have to remember something. Iran is not a future United States in the making. They've had 3 to 5 million people leave Iran. They're also facing serious problems with water, which within 50 years means, in one study, 40% of Iranians will leave the country. And many of the young people, and the majority of people under 30 are young, they know what the rest of the world is like, and they don't want to work for a couple hundred dollars and be restricted by the government and so forth. So there is ability to put pressure on, and we saw it in the Green Movement 10 years ago, which was in urban areas, and we saw it in rural areas about a month or two ago, where there was widespread discontent with the regime. It's not so much over their foreign policy, it's their complete ineptness at home.
Do you think that Mr. Trump will be persuaded to change his position as a result of these European visits?
He's a businessman, and he's looking for the art of the deal. And so for him, what you put forth at first is not necessarily what you get at the end.
Brian Hook, the State Department's policy planning director, who has been discussing with Germany, France, and Britain ways to keep the U.S. in the deal, told National Public Radio some progress has been made. In Geneva, Assistant Secretary of State for International Security and Nonproliferation Christopher Ford said the U.S. is not aiming to renegotiate the accord, but trying to come up with a supplemental agreement that will keep the U.S. in it. Here are some other top stories from around the globe. The much-feared Day Zero, the day the drought-hit city of Cape Town was supposed to be shutting off the taps of water as it was running out, has been quietly pushed back from this month to sometime in 2019. A high court in Pakistan has removed and debarred the country's foreign minister from holding public office for life for concealing his foreign assets. And the Armenian parliament on Thursday called for an extraordinary session next week to vote on a new prime minister after the country was plunged into a political crisis with the abrupt resignation of its leader. For in-depth coverage to these stories and more, visit voanews.com or download our mobile application to take the stories with you. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Two teams of astronomers have peered back almost 12 and a half billion years in time, or when the universe was only 1.4 billion years old, to watch the early stages of a massive cosmic pileup. Using the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array and the Atacama Pathfinder experiment in Chile, the astronomers were able to observe a dense concentration of 14 young starburst galaxies that were getting ready to collide violently and produce a gigantic galaxy cluster. It's thought that this megacluster could become one of the biggest structures in the known universe. Each of the individual galaxies that would make up this cluster are said to be spitting out stars some 1,000 times faster than our Milky Way galaxy in an area of space that is only about three times its size. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. Friday, April 27th will mark only the third time the leaders of South and North Korea will have met face-to-face. The first meeting took place in 2000 between South Korean President Kim Dae-jung and North Korea's Kim Jong-il. The second meeting took place in 2007 between South Korean President Noh Moon-hyun and Kim Jong-il as well. Earlier today, I spoke with VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Brian Padden, and I started our conversation by asking him to describe what we could expect to see during tomorrow's summit between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in.
Today, we got a good rundown from South Korean officials on the schedule of events for tomorrow. And it seems to be long on pomp and circumstance, but so far a bit short on substance. Kim Jong-un is going to cross the military demarcation line at 8:30 in the morning. He'll be met there by South Korean President Moon Jae-in. The two will review an honor guard that we'll be waiting for. There'll be a ceremony, a reception ceremony with an honor guard review. This is similar to how North Korea received the president of South Korea during the previous two summits that were held in the North. And so they will follow a bit of that format. There'll be a tree planting ceremony. There'll be a photo op. They may take a walk along this footbridge that crosses the border, this historic footbridge that was called the Bridge of No Return, in which prisoners from the Korean War were exchanged at the end of the war in 1953. So we have a list of all of these activities. There'll be two meetings. There'll be a morning meeting and an afternoon meeting. At the end of the day, there will be a joint communique. The expectation is that the major focus of this summit will be on denuclearization and not only serving up a joint commitment to remove all nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula, but to also detail what that would mean and perhaps set the tone and maybe set a framework for the next summit that's coming, which would be between Kim and U.S. President Donald Trump.
Does South Korea have any other expectations from this meeting, whether it be discussions on human rights or perhaps a commitment to allow families who are separated by the Korean War to meet?
There will be some focus on the family unifications, on exchanges, on cooperation. But unlike in past summits, South Korea is quite restrained in what it can offer in these summits. The international sanctions imposed prohibits South Korean President Moon Jae-in from actually offering any economic cooperation. They also said in the Blue House that human rights will not be addressed at this particular summit, to the dismay of a number of defectors and advocates for human rights and these issues. Also, they will talk about a possible peace treaty to replace the armistice that was signed over 60 years ago to end the war, and a peace treaty that would work to kind of ease relations and improve kind of security exchanges of information and those types of things. But a peace treaty also cannot be done between North and South Korea alone. That would require the other countries that signed the truce back then, which would include China and the United States.
If we pull back from Panmunjom and take a look at the individuals living in South Korea, how are they viewing the meeting tomorrow?
I think there is optimism here, more so probably than in the United States, where at least from my distance, I'm hearing a lot of skepticism. I think there's a lot of support for the outreach to North Korea here. I mean, President Moon was elected last year with a very strong majority. And so I think people are somewhat optimistic. But, you know, people here, they don't get too freaked out. The tensions are high. And I don't think they're buying totally into the fact that this is a life-changing historic event that's about to happen. There's very much a wait-and-see attitude.
That was VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Brian Padden. U.S. President Donald Trump may win his travel restriction case at the U.S. Supreme Court. VOA's Jeff Custer reports after oral arguments were heard at the High Court on Wednesday.
Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Anthony Kennedy both signaled support for the travel policy in arguments Wednesday, and challengers almost certainly need one of those two justices if the court is to strike down the ban on travelers from several mostly Muslim countries. The travel ban case is the court's first comprehensive look at a Trump policy, one of considerable importance to the president and highly controversial since it was first rolled out a week after Trump took office. While three other liberal justices raised questions about the policy, Justice Sonia Sotomayor was the most aggressive questioner of Solicitor General Noel Francisco in his defense of the Trump policy.
The claim is that the proclamation is in place because of a dislike of a particular religion. And I thought the Establishment Clause at its heart is that we cannot be anything but neutral with respect to religion or its practice.
The justices voted in December to allow the policy to take full effect, pending their full consideration. Wednesday was the first time they took it up in open court. The Trump administration is asking the court to reverse lower court rulings that would strike down the ban. The Supreme Court is considering whether the president can indefinitely keep people out of the country based on nationality. It is also looking at whether the policy is aimed at excluding Muslims from the United States. Justice Kennedy challenged lawyer Neil Katyal, representing the policy's opponents, about whether the ban would be unending.
The executive order is unlawful for three reasons. It conflicts with Congress's policy choices. It defies the bar on nationality discrimination, something you never heard my friend talk about. And it violates the First Amendment.
Well, the statute says for the 1182, for such period as he deems necessary, and he can have continuing supervision over whether it's still necessary.
again, we wouldn't have a problem with that if it was tailored to a crisis as it sunsets and then, you know, could be re-upped or something like that. That's not what this says. This is about a perpetual problem.
You want the president to say, I'm convinced that in 6 months we're going to have a safe world.
Well, no, Justice Kennedy, that's not our argument.
The justices are looking at the third version of a policy that Trump first rolled out a week after taking office, triggering chaos and protests across the U.S. as travelers were stopped from boarding international flights and detained at airports for hours. The first version was blocked by courts and withdrawn. Its replacement was allowed to take partial effect, but expired in September. The current version is indefinite and now applies to travelers from five countries with overwhelmingly Muslim populations: Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. It also affects two non-Muslim countries, blocking travelers from North Korea and some Venezuelan government officials and their families. A sixth majority Muslim country, Chad, was removed from the list this month. A decision is expected by late June. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
On the next edition of VOA's Press Conference USA, host Carol Castiel goes to Capitol Hill to talk with Congressman Brad Snyder, a Democrat from Illinois. They'll discuss a wide range of domestic and foreign policy issues facing the Trump administration, such as this week's visit by French President Emmanuel Macron, as well as Iran, North Korea, and trade policies. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition from The Voice of America. The freedom to wear whatever you want is taken for granted here in the U.S., but some people's idea of fashion options is being viewed by others as condoning the repression of women. In her first television interview, a U.S. designer of Muslim clothing explains her decision, why she gave her design line. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti has the story.
Lisa Vogel is more than just a few clicks away from her German Catholic roots in central Michigan.
Tell me if I poke you.
Okay. I think I only had like two Muslims that I know of that I grew up with in my school.
Vogel developed an interest in the Islamic faith through a photography project. She later converted and started designing the clothing she couldn't find in stores.
They don't cater to the religious requirements of a hijabi Muslim.
Vogel started the Verona Collection, a modest clothing line that features hijabs in what fashion bloggers describe as colors that pop.
Half of the May production is actually going to be shot this Friday.
She opened a retail store in Florida, but converted it to a warehouse after a major department store took notice. Macy's, yes, one of America's largest, oldest department stores, is carrying Verona on its website.
There's now women that look like me, or dress like me, I should say, being represented on Macy's.
Not everyone agrees with this arrangement. Some point to the women of Syria who burned their hijabs after the defeat of the Islamic State, or the Iranian woman who was jailed after removing hers in public.
Some tweets have demanded a boycott, one suggesting that Macy's is supporting the oppression of women.
Hey, do you want to try it on?
Sure.
Rather than backing down from the controversy, Vogel says she's offering Muslim women a choice.
What's happening overseas has nothing to do with me. It absolutely doesn't. I'm here just offering clothing options.
It's an option that could help Macy's, which closed 100 of its stores in the past 2 years. Globally, consumers spend about $250 billion on Muslim attire. But it's a sensitive topic for women who grew up in Iran, including women's rights activist Parvaneh Hosseini.
It is ignorant towards what hijab means in other parts of the world.
Hosseini says the store should take a stance against the enforcement of hijab. Despite repeated attempts, Macy's declined to speak with VOA. Vogel says she has no intention of dropping her clothing line to concede to critics. Instead, she's focused on making Verona a regular staple at more department stores. Carolyn Presutti, VOA News, Orlando, Florida.
It is going to be a family affair. Britain's royal officials say Prince Harry has asked elder brother Prince William to be the best man at his wedding on May 19th. Zuria Shackley has the details from the Associated Press.
Kensington Palace says that William is honored to be playing the key role when Harry marries actress Meghan Markle at Windsor Castle on the 19th of May. Harry was best man when William married Kate Middleton at Westminster Abbey in 2011. About 600 guests have been invited to watch 33-year-old Harry and Markle, who's 36, tie the knot at St. George's Chapel. About 2,600 neighbours, staff and specially selected members of the public will get to greet the couple outside the chapel. Sarah Shackley, London.
And you know what? That is going to do it for today's show. You know, I want to thank Patrice Martin for directing this episode, as well as Wojtek Zarniak for engineering the broadcast. He's the one that makes this show sound so good. But most importantly, I want to thank you for spending part of your day with me here on VOA's International Edition. My name is Steve Miller in Washington. You know what? Have an absolutely fantastic day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Intellectual property is a term that refers to unique creations of the human mind that are subsequently recognized and protected by law, such as inventions, literary and artistic works, as well as symbols, names, images, and designs used in commerce. It includes musical performances, films, fashion, advances in technology or medicine, and innovations on existing design in every field and genre. Simply put, intellectual property represents our genius. Stealing intellectual property is no less of a crime than stealing someone's wallet or damaging their sale goods. Some consequences of intellectual property theft are obvious. If a patient is treated with counterfeit medication, his or her health could suffer, or they could die. Intellectual property theft deprives artists, inventors, and innovators of their just compensation and cheats purchasers of pirated goods because the value of the purchase is less than advertised. Some of the lesser-known forms of intellectual property theft include appropriation of trade secrets and specialized know-how, usually through cyber theft, and compulsory transfer of technology from transnational companies to the government of a country on whose territory they wish to conduct business. Still, one of the most serious consequences of intellectual property theft is that it stifles creativity and innovation. Why dedicate effort and resources to creation or innovation if one is not likely to reap commensurate rewards? On April 26th, we observe World Intellectual Property Day to celebrate creativity, to acknowledge the contributions of creators, inventors, and innovators to the development of societies across the globe, and to raise awareness of how patents, copyright, and trademarks contribute to humanity's progress. This year's theme, Women in Innovation and Creativity, is designed to celebrate women's contributions to intellectual property. The protection and enforcement of intellectual property rights help ensure the world will continue to benefit from the time, resources, and brain power invested in developing new technologies and improvement of existing ones, from the works of some of our most creative citizens, and from new brands and modes of production. On this day, as we celebrate the human capacity to create, innovate, and invent, we call on all our friends and partners to stiffen intellectual property laws where needed and enforce them strictly for the sake of us all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.